Okay, good evening, everyone. Broadcasting live. January 5th. Just doing audio for now. Because we will be recording a Dhammapada video. Test. All right, I guess we're ready. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verse number 124, which reads as follows. Panimhi jevano nasa hareya panina visang anabannang visamanveti Nati papang akupato, which means panimhiche vano nasa, if there should be no wound in the hand, there should be no wound on the hand, no cut on the hand. Hareya panina visang, one might carry poison or pick up poison with the hand. Nabanang visamanveti. But Nabanang visamanveti. Poison cannot harm, right? Sorry. Yeah, let me try this again, actually. Sorry, I'm a little behind here. Just going to record that again. I'm going to look up the Pali. What does that mean? Na abanang isam anveti. Cannot enter, maybe. Not harm, huh? Okay, got it. Sorry about that. Let me start again. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verse number 124, which reads as follows. Panimhi jevano nasa hareya panina visang nabanang visamanveti nati papang akubbato, which means if one should not have a wound, if there should not be a wound in the on the hand, a cut on the hand, hareya panina visang, one might pick up poison with the hand. For nabanang visamanveti, for poison doesn't enter and doesn't harm one without a cut, one without a wound. Nati papang akubato. And likewise, evil, there is no evil for one who does not do it. Nati papang akubato. For one who does not perform it, Nati papang, there is no evil. So this is actually an important verse. It's kind of unique in answering this question, a certain question. And so a little bit of backstory. It's a fairly well-known story of the hunter Kukutamita. But the story is more about his wife. Or it's about the two of them. So it starts with his wife. His wife, it seems, became a sotapanna when she was very young. So she must have maybe listened to what the Buddha had said, or maybe even practiced meditation based on what another monk had taught. But it was in Rajagaha she lived. And kind of Kundala Kesi, this woman who became an ascetic, then became a Buddha ascetic and then a Buddhist monk. When she was young, they kept her up on the seventh floor of this kind of palace to try and keep her away from men. If you remember the story of Kundala Kesi, how she snuck out while this woman, the wife of Kukutamita, did the same thing. But how it happened here is that she looked out a window one day and saw a hunter, Kukutamita, coming into the city to sell his deer. He killed deer, so he brought 500, probably not 500, but many, 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 many deer. He put them in a cart and brought them into the city to sell, or cut them up and was selling their flesh. And when she saw him, she fell in love with him, kind of love at first sight kind of thing. And so she snuck out with the servants by dressing herself in rags and dirtying her face and so on, and followed after the hunter as he left the city. Now he tried to get her to go away, and she wouldn't go away until finally he realized what she was after, and so he picked her up and put her in his cart and carried her on his way. And they lived together from that time on. Her mother and father, when they found that she was missing, they looked for her everywhere, couldn't find her, and thought that she was dead, and they had a funeral ceremony for her and everything. But meanwhile, she's living in the forest with this hunter, and over time had seven sons. And these seven sons got married and lived with seven women, and so altogether there were 16 of them. This is the story. And this is the backstory. So we come to the present time, where the Buddha, which he was wont to do in the morning, they say when the Buddha lay down to sleep, he would spend his time, he would lie down during the night to rest, and he would send his mind out to the universe, trying to decide who he would teach that day. Who was ready? Was it maybe someone in the village that he was in, or maybe it was someone far away, or maybe it was even the angels up in heaven, in one of the heavens? And when he decided, when he came upon someone who seemed ready, he would find a way to get to them. And so on this day, he saw these 16 people, and he considered that all of them, first of all, he knew that the wife was already a sotapanna, but he knew the rest of them would benefit if he were to go to them. And so he walked through the forest and came upon the nets. And it happened on that day that the hunter didn't catch anything. So maybe it's somehow karmic or somehow related to the Buddha, but at any rate, all of his nets were empty. All of his nets and his snares, and whereas normally he would always catch deer, on this day he didn't catch anything. And so the Buddha went to one of the nets and stepped into the net with his foot, leaving a footprint that the hunter would see, leaving tracks. He left footprints by the net. And so the hunter came by to check on his nets, Kukutamita. He came to see what he had caught, found that he hadn't caught anything, and started getting more and more annoyed. Till finally he came upon the net with the footprints. And he thought to himself, someone's been freeing these deer. Someone's been setting the deer free, has been maybe robbing me of my game. And so he went and he followed the tracks and he came upon the Buddha. And here's the story gets a little bit supernatural. And, you know, I don't want to really be too hard on these stories because I don't know. I mean, magical things could happen. But I know it's hard for a modern audience because we don't have these kind of magical powers now. And many people are skeptical that anyone ever did have these magical powers. So here's how it goes down. He sees the Buddha, and he and all of his sons draw their bows and are ready to shoot the Buddha. That part is in the story, and that part, you know, don't have to get into the magic for that. His wife sees them draw with their bows drawn, pointed at the Buddha, and cries out at them, "Don't kill my father," she says. "Don't kill my father. What are you doing? You're going to kill my father. Please don't." And they were shocked. They all completely sobered up and were in shock because they didn't know who her father was, obviously, because she had lost connection with her family. But here, this was her father. Her father was a monk. Of course, that wasn't the case, but this is how Buddhists would look. Enlightened Buddhists from Sotapanna on up will look at the Buddha as being their father. And so they were all ashamed and they put their bows down, went and paid respect to him. "This is my father-in-law, this is your grandfather," and so on. And they were all friendly towards him. So you see, I didn't have to get into any supernatural. Now any magic. Now what the story says is he came and he drew his bow and the Buddha made him unable to shoot. So he froze him in place. And then all the seven sons came slowly and they held up their bows and they likewise were frozen, became frozen in place. And they stayed like that for a while, actually. The Buddha had them frozen in place. And the wife was wondering where they'd been and where they went, what happened to them, why they weren't back for lunch, maybe. And so she went out and found where they were. The Buddha was just meditating there, and they're all frozen in place, and then she cried out, "Do not kill my father, do not kill my father." So you take which version you prefer, I don't mind. And so they sat down and they asked forgiveness from the Buddha and they listened to his teaching. And upon listening to his teaching, all of the other 15, they called the daughters, the seven daughter-in-laws as well. And altogether, all 15 of them became Sotapanna. So along with the wife, that made 16 of them. We're now enlightened being, or Sotapanna. And he went back to the Buddha, after preaching, he went back to the monastery and Ananda saw him and Ananda asked him, "Where have you been?" And the Buddha told him what he had done and he said, "Oh, did they all become Sotapanna?" And he said, "Well, they all did except for his wife, but she had been a Sotapanna since she was a girl." And wow, so Ananda was impressed and or whatever, and but the monks got wind of this because, you see, the curious thing there is, and as they were talking about it, they thought, well, that's understandable. I mean, Angulimala became an arahant, so hunters can become Sotapanna. But the problem here, and it's a problem that the monks had when they were discussing it, is she was a sotapanna from a girl, so what the heck was she doing with a hunter? Because a sotapanna is incapable of killing intentionally. Really, a sotapanna shouldn't be able to perform any significantly immoral act, like killing or stealing or cheating or lying, or even drugs and alcohol they wouldn't get involved in. And so they said, you know, what the heck's going on here? How could she have been a sotapanna when she's cleaning his traps and his arrows and preparing them for him and putting out his bow and arrows and doing all these things that ostensibly she would have to do as a hunter's wife, maybe even cleaning carcasses and so on, you know, cooking the meat that he had killed, even eating the meat that he had killed. Certainly eating it, right? And when he says, bring me my bow, bring me my arrows, bring me my hunting knife, bring me my net, she would obey him. And then using that, he would go and take life. So how could she do that if she was a sotapanna? And here's was the Buddha's reply. Monks, of course, those that have obtained sotapanna do not take life. Kukutamita's wife did what she did because she was actuated by the thought, I will obey the commands of my husband. That was a thing in India. It never occurred to her to think, he will take what I give him and go hence to take life. Never occurred to her to think that. Well, I mean, I suppose that's maybe stretching it. Maybe the translation's a bit off. But she didn't think. That wasn't the thought that she had. She didn't think about him taking life. If a man's hand be free from wounds, even though he take poison into his hand, yet the poison will not harm him. Precisely so, a man who harbors no thoughts of wrong and who commits no evil may take down bows and other similar objects and present them to another, and yet be guiltless of sin. And then he gave this verse. And this is, I think this is quite controversial. You know, this leads into the controversy that we often face about how Buddhists can eat meat, some Buddhists, us Buddhists, my tradition. How can you eat meat? How can you be so hypocritical when you say killing is wrong and yet eating meat is okay? And it's this verse that really drives that teaching home. Because ethics in Buddhism is quite different from ethics as we think of it. And so this kind of confusion and criticism comes quite often as a result, because people have ordinary ideas of ethics. Something is wrong because it hurts someone else. But, you know, since you can't know what is going to hurt someone else, it makes many things potentially wrong. I mean, you can't then easily draw a line in the sand. I mean, I don't know what consequences my actions are going to have, right? And then you might argue that based on this, there's a greater likelihood or so on, but you see, you can't draw a line in the sand, which points to how problematic that kind of ethics is, but it still misses the point that our ethics are categorically different. Our ethics don't involve the consequences to others. Ethics are solely how they affect you. So if I hurt you, that's unethical from a Buddhist point of view because of the damage it does to my mind. The damage it does to your face is not directly involved in the equation. Now, if you get angry because I hit you, then that in and of itself is unethical of you. So if you are sad and are hurt and suffer because of what I did to you, then that is unethical. You suffering is unethical because you're hurting yourself. So it's very much self-centered, and that's another criticism that Buddhism faces. But it's funny how we really get a lot of hard criticism like this, and vegetarians will often get quite upset about Buddhists, and there's this divide that we can't bridge because they think they're right in getting upset, and we think they're wrong. We think you're the unethical one. You getting angry at me for sitting here chewing something that is dead is a problem. The anger that you have, me sitting here eating something that is dead, is not a problem. I'm just chewing, swallowing, and so on. Our idea of ethics is quite different. And so, if you carry if you carry poison in your hand, it only hurts you if you have a cut. And the same idea is with acts. So if I shoot a bow at a tree, and it turns out that the tree is, you know, maybe it's someone dressed up in a tree costume, and the person dies. Or, you know, maybe there's a person in the tree that I didn't see. I'm not guilty. There's no crime in that. There's no problem. On the other hand, if I shoot at the tree thinking I see a bird in the tree, and it turns out there was no bird in the tree, I've still done a very, very evil thing. My intention was evil. You see, it's still a bad karma, because I had a bad intention. There's an interesting story of the past. I suppose I shouldn't go into it because it'll take way too much time. But so the key here is understanding ethics. Someone recently asked me about how it was about monks not being able to act as doctors, and the idea that how cruel that would be if you came upon someone who was sick and didn't help them, who was dying and didn't help them. And this idea of the cruelty and the idea of lacking compassion and so on, it's really looking at things, and this is why people get kind of misled by compassion, because it's just like in this case of not being able to do anything, being totally paralyzed if you had to really consider the consequences of what you did. By the same token, if you were required to help anyone anytime you could, then we'd never rest. We'd collapse in exhaustion, because we'd always be capable of helping others. So the idea that compassion means helping people when you can, or even when you hear about it, is it's something that you have to, you know, has to definitely be tempered with wisdom and understanding. It has to be led by wisdom and understanding. If it was just about helping when you can, you know, then you'd never end. And you'd never really help anyone, you never really change the world, because there'd always be more people. There will always be people who need help. And furthermore, those people who you do help, there's no telling what's going to happen to them in the future, except that really, in the end, they're going to die anyway. So, I mean, all of it points to the idea of really having a wisdom-based concept of ethics and morality and goodness and compassion. Now, definitely, you should help people when you have the opportunity. Now, monks have certain rules, and monks are very, very, you know, have devoted themselves to a path. But even still, the idea that you have to help people, and there are stories about how you should kill, you know, these dilemmas of how you should kill five people to save one, or if there's a time bomb, you should. Let's put that one aside. But you do a lesser evil to prevent a greater evil, but it implies that you are required to do something, it's unethical to do nothing, or it's or in the case of this story, it's unethical to do anything that's related to evil. If the consequences of the act are evil, you see, so the consequences of action or the consequences of omission, then this isn't how Buddhism looks at it. Now, if someone is suffering in front of me, Now, technically, I can be at peace with myself without helping them. This is possible. Now, I would argue that in most cases, you would not be at peace with yourself. In most cases, being at peace with yourself just naturally is helping the person. I mean, that's, I think, how compassion works. But in certain circumstances, where maybe they're being, someone's attacking someone else, right? And the only way to fix the situation would be to maybe harm the first person, maybe hit them or so on. So hurt the other person. I mean, I don't even know then. I think even then you could argue that you should act. But there is a line, you see. There is a line which requires defilement, that you wouldn't act. And the same, I think, goes for acts. Like if you were to not do it, it would cause problems. You know, doing it is the going with the flow. So you say, well, her handing him his bow and arrow was enabling him. Well, that's not how she thought of it. For her, it was a mindful act. My husband asked me for something, I get it for him. I remember when I was, many, many years ago, I was working in a restaurant, and we had to serve alcohol. And I was already practicing meditation, I wasn't a monk yet. And so I had to carry the alcohol to the people, and I thought, well, this isn't very ethical. You know, here I'm enabling them. But I thought of this verse, actually. I had read the Dhammapada, and I thought of this verse, and so I thought, okay, this is what I'm doing. I'm lifting the bottle, lifting this thing, you know, moving it and placing it. I'm actually doing a good deed. I'm serving someone. I really enjoyed being a waiter for the short time that I did it, because I was serving people. It was a kindness, really, or it was a humbling activity. And so this is important. I mean, it's important as Buddhists philosophically to understand where we stand, understand why we stand that way. We stand this way because we're interested in happiness and we're interested in peace. And because our understanding is that you have to find happiness and peace for yourself. No one else can do it for you. No one else can also either make you suffer. If someone hurts you, it's up to you how you react to that. So our idea of ethics and morality have very much to do with our state of mind when we do something. And if you can eat meat without any thoughts of harm, and the Buddha said, you know, you send love and kindness, compassion, send out these thoughts, then you can do that while you're eating meat. And I know many people don't like this idea. They think this is horrible. I've actually had people get angry at me, and there's this divide where they can't understand us. But why I thought it was funny is because it doesn't really matter. You know, if you get angry at me and you believe I'm evil and cruel because I won't make medicines for people or because I won't go out of my way to help people or so on, I mean, it doesn't really matter. It's a problem for you because it makes you suffer. I feel sorry for you, and I hope that you can free yourself from that. But it really fails, you know. I mean, you can say someone is cruel, but cruelty is a state of mind. And we have these sort of nebulous ideas of ethics and morality and goodness and compassion and right and wrong that just have much more to do with our partiality. We don't want to see people suffer. We get angry and upset when people suffer. When we hear about these animals that die, or we hear about animals that are killed, we get arrogant and self-righteous and angry, and we think we're in the right, and that's why we end up getting burnt out. You know, activists, people who work for social justice, often burn out because they are full of emotion and they're full of want and desire for change, and it burns you out. And they never look carefully to see that, oh yeah, you know, in the end the universe, the world, the sun is going to explode and burn the earth to a crisp anyway. And you can't save this earth. You can't save mankind, humankind. You can't solve the problems of the world. There's no logical reason to try. All you can do is what's right. Do good. Do good things. Better yourself. Because your mind stays with you. The only thing that stays with you is your mind. It's really a very, very solipsistic sort of viewpoint, but I think that's proper. It's not that we don't believe other people exist, it's that they exist in their own world. We can't change their world, we can't live their world for them. And whatever good we can do for them is only as a catalyst. I think there's room for not supporting hunters, for even telling hunters that it's a, you know, problematic. I think there's even room, you could argue, for a husband or a wife to tell their husband or their wife that they disagree with hunting, that they wish for beings to not have to die or something. I think there's room for being a vegetarian if you like. I think it's a good thing. But we have to be very careful when we accuse or when we make claims of what is moral and what is ethical as these monks. And it has to be based on our understanding, a proper understanding of morality. So that's the teaching. How it relates to our meditation practice is meditation is a way that you really understand this. You understand what the universe is made of, how it works, and you start to get very logical and rational about things. You stop freaking out or getting upset and judging acts and people. Like when you see someone who does, you hear about someone who does evil things, or you think of someone, or you know someone who does evil things, you don't think of them as an evil person, because you know how it goes. They probably have some very good mind states at times. And even if they don't, it's still just temporary. They can always become a better person. But I mean, more clearly, they aren't really a person. Those states are just states. It's not an evil person. It's cause and effect. It's got reasons and causes where it comes from, and it's just states of mind, states of body that arise and cease. And to us, it's just experiences. This person yelling at me is just sound. This person hitting me is just a feeling, or then pain. This person stealing my things is just a thought that I have, that that's mine, and that's a person stealing something that belongs to me. Meditation is what helps you understand this. And it really, I was a vegetarian up until the time I practiced meditation, and then I stopped, and even today I'm still not a full vegetarian. I mean, and I've always thought it's a good thing. You know, I understand that meat comes from a bad place usually, so I like to be vegetarian, but I think that's an important sort of attitude to have, is not be too serious or too obsessed with, you know, trying to fix the world, you know, trying to solve all the problems. I think on the other hand, it's good not to be complacent, and it is good to help. It's good to speak out. It's good to say what's right. It's good to try to help people. It's good to try to be kind and compassionate. But it's not about ethics. It's about, really about going with the flow. Going with not the flow of people necessarily, but with the flow of life, which can be somewhat cause friction and create conflict at times. But it has more to do with your state of mind, not upsetting the equilibrium in your mind, not upsetting your mind or giving rise to greed, anger, or delusion. That's really all. Because nothing unethical can come to you except through one of these three things. Anyway, it's complex, and I think people complicate it. And I imagine that I'll probably, for this kind of talk, I'll get a lot of people confused and uncertain. I think that's why it's important to meditate. I mean, even rather than taking anything I've said or any of these things as solid views or dogma or so on, most important is that you find out for yourself. You learn for yourself what is ethical. Don't believe your gut or your feeling or what you've been taught, because we have a lot of wrong ideas and wrong habits of understanding. And try to look at reality, watch how your mind works, learn how your mind works, and come to see for yourself what is a truly ethical act. So, anyway, that's the Dhammapada teaching for tonight. Thank you all for tuning in. Wish you all good practice. Okay, that's that. Was the audio working properly? Nope, so. You could hear me, no, Robin?
Yes, I can hear you, Bhante.
Okay. Well, that's all that's important.
I don't have the audio on, I'm just listening through the Hangout, but hopefully it was working.
Okay, so now we go live with video. Hello everyone, broadcasting live. Oops, we're now live. Hello everyone, we're broadcasting live January 5th, 2016. We just did a Dhammapada video. I apologize for yesterday, I expected to be out for the morning, right? But then we went for lunch after this meeting. I went with this Chinese monk and Ivan. And then he took me up to see his 80-acre piece of property up at Stouffville. And then he said, you know, is there anywhere else you want to go? He had a free day, I guess. And I said, oh, I'm sure we can think of somewhere to go, just joking. And I started thinking, and then I said, I wonder how far we are from my father. It turned out we were about an hour away from where my father lives. So I gave him a call, and we drove out there. And spent about an hour at my father's house. And it was funny, this Chinese monk, he said that was the first Western, you know, non-Asian family whose house he's ever been in. Which is, no, he's been here 30 years in Canada. So it was quite an experience. He's a nice guy. We have different ideas of Buddhism, but we don't talk about it. So we're good. I forgot that Amitabha is a Buddha. I was confusing with Avalokiteshvara, who's a Bodhisattva. But Amitabha is actually a Buddha. They have this idea that there's a Buddha up in the Pure Land who, if you chant his name or her name, I don't know, then you can go to their Western Pure Land, where all the Buddhas live, or you all live as Buddhas or something. I remember talking to a Chinese nun about this who came to practice Vipassana. I think I really struck a chord with her. It was really interesting because no one there had sort of challenged her faith, and I kind of challenged it. I said, you know, how is that different from Christianity? And I think maybe she was even like, well, Christianity is also good. And I said, well, okay, but how is that different from the flying spaghetti monster? Do you know about the flying spaghetti monster?
Yes.
How is it different? And I really, really, no one had ever, I mean, I'm equipped with all this ammunition because I've been really thinking and talking and learning about all this, these different arguments that people have, and really kind of threw her off guard, I think. It was interesting. Turn this off. Take that out. So tomorrow we'll have meditation. Today I started school again. I don't know about this school thing. My father's happy though. He's glad I'm doing it, so there's that. Ivan says I should do it. This Chinese monk. I don't know. Sort of have to finish this year out, but we'll see. Maybe next year I can take more interesting, more useful courses. You know, it's nice to learn languages. We got those carob chips and stuff. Did you send that, Robin?
Yes. Well, the carob powder and the dandelion coffee and all that
So we're
delicious
hosting, for those of
food.
you who haven't heard, we're hosting this Hamilton Interfaith group. It's Hamilton Interfaith Peace Group, I think is what it's called. So it's different religions coming together to talk about peace and to find ways to spread peace. So every year they have a conference, and we're planning a conference. We're going to tell stories this year, stories about peace. And so this year our theme is the environment as well. So it's going to, the idea is to talk about how the environment relates to peace. I mean, it's not a very Buddhist thing, but kind of, you know, there are aspects of peace that involve the environment, I think. There's interesting stories about it, but the idea of there's a good one about being grateful and at least being mindful, you know, mindful that where our food comes from, you know, and mindful of our environment. I think that's a big thing because, you know, it's lack of mindfulness, lack of like just forgetting or not paying attention to what we're doing to the world. And Buddhism believes that we've been degrading since we started sticking to this earth. See, we were like angels, celestial beings, and then we began to associate with this globe, you know, the earth, and then taste from it. And as we became more involved with it, our bodies became coarser until we were stuck to it. And as we got stuck to it, you know, slowly became more and more coarse, more and more physical, until today. And so in modern times, we tend to think the opposite, right? We think we're advancing. You know, we've built up all these neat tools and gadgets and so on, and this is really advancing. But at the same time, we're ignoring the fact that the world around us is disgusting, is just uglier and uglier every day, right? The rainforests we're cutting down, the air that we're polluting, the water we're polluting. There's an island the size of Texas, apparently, of plastic. An island of plastic the size of Texas, somewhere out in the Pacific Ocean, something like that. It's not more beautiful. It's not more comfortable. It's not more pleasant. So the environment is interesting. I'm just interested in the peace aspect. I'm interested in being involved to talk about about peace with these people and do my part, you know. Anyway, so we're hosting that, and so we're trying to think of food as peace and mindfulness of food and that kind of thing. So mindfulness that our food should be medicine, and you can't just eat anything. I don't know. Don't want to obsess too much, but I thought, well, okay, if we're doing it, then we should get food. No, they said they wanted to talk this week about food as peace, because in a social level, food and peace are related, you know. Slave labor and government manipulation, international manipulation of markets, turning countries into banana republics, or growing nothing but sugar in a country so that no one has anything to eat in the country, you know. And taking all the land to grow food for luxury food for foreign entities. They put all the people on one small part of the land, and the rest of it is owned by the corporations. This is how many of the Central and South American countries work, I think. Or they used to, anyway. I don't know how it is now. Anyway, do you have any questions?
We do.
All right, let's go through a few.
Okay. And just another comment. Samantha sent carob snacks that actually look delicious, unlike the rest of the stuff, which looks a little health foody. But we do have questions. If the universe has no purpose, why does it exist?
I don't know. That's the one question I can't answer. I have no idea why the universe exists. No idea whatsoever. Can't figure it out. So the answer we do have is what to do about it, you know, which is really more important. I mean, philosophers have struggled with that for the longest time. It's why they came up with God. I mean, it's this don't understand ergo God. That's the argument. But that's always been the argument. It's raining. Why is it raining? It must be God. Lightning. What is that? Must be God.
And
this person
angry.
Got sick. Must be God. No, that's Satan, you know, or whatever, you know. You have, must be this, must be that. I did this chant, and this person got healed of their sickness. Must be God. These atheists call it the God of the gaps. So for as long as there are gaps in our learning, we can... This is as long as God is going to last. As we learn more, God will disappear. But it's not even that. You know, there are some things that we just can't know. I think part of it is being inside the system. We're good at figuring out systems that we're not involved in, but systems that we are involved in are problematic for us to understand. I mean, what we do know is that there's no entities. So the universe, of course, doesn't exist. All that exists is this moment, and this moment is, you know, constantly changing. I mean, the moment as an entity maybe exists. The experience exists. It's one experience and one experience and one experience.
Would it be possible to take the Daily Dhamma audio and make a daily podcast from it? It would be nice to listen to it on the go whenever I can't tune in live or sit down to watch YouTube.
Yeah,
I think
it would
be
pretty easy to create a... You want a feed, right? An RSS feed or something.
Yeah, we did point out that there is the live archive.
Yeah.
So you can listen to it in MP3 format from there.
Yeah, it would be pretty easy. You just put together a PHP script. If someone wants to put together a PHP script, I can host it. It's pretty easy. I even have one, I think. Just adapt it, maybe. Yeah, it's pretty easy, actually. I probably got the script that we need.
Hello, Bhante. When I am at work, can I note working instead of each individual action?
It's not very useful. I mean, you're not going to learn much that way. It'll keep you kind of present, but yeah, not exactly. It is useful, absolutely, because you are working, and that's what you're doing. It keeps you present, so you will start to see things arising and ceasing. So it's not wrong per se. But it's imprecise. That word is not going to get you to know very clearly every movement. It's not going to keep you on your toes. And it's not going to be able to help you distinguish physical and mental. It's blurry, you see, because working, it involves the thoughts and intentions and so on. It kind of blurs over too much.
Hello, Bhante. I found Buddhist beliefs and teachings to be based on experience and our clear understanding of reality, hence would like to know more about how rebirth is a confirmed occurrence. I guess the question is, how is everyone so sure rebirth happens at all?
Is this person a meditator? Oh, they are.
Yes.
Right. How is everyone sure rebirth occurs at all? We're not sure, most of us. But then we're not sure death occurs either. So the question is, which one is more likely? And that's, I think, up for debate. I think the reason we lean more towards death being likely, people in general, and not Buddhists, but people in general lean more towards the idea of death as opposed to continuation, is because we think of the world as in terms of entities and third and impersonal entities. So we think of things as being broken. We think of a light as being turned off, right? When you turn off your computer, the power is like sucked out of it. This is the idea, the computer is now off. When you turn off your car, the engine shuts down, right? But that's all, first of all, it's imprecise, because when you shut off the engine, nothing disappears. It just, things stop moving, you could say. But all the components are still there. And the same goes with death. When a person dies, components don't disappear. But we think of the mind as like motion or something, right? But it's not like motion. This is the key. Yes, the motor does stop, but that's all the physical. And yes, the body does shut down. That's all physical. And it's really kind of meaningless, because all of the components are still there. And the human body slowly disperses, but that's all it is it just disperses. So the question is, what happens to the mind? Does the mind disperse? And so they argue that the mind is like motion, or the mind is like heat, or the mind is like sound. But it's not, really. I mean, all of those things are still products of matter. They're still matter-based things. They're still what you would call, what John Locke would call, secondary qualities of matter. They're not mental. The ideas of them, ideas of these things, are something quite different, or the experiences of these things that arise in the mind are totally different. And so, as Buddhists, we lean towards the idea of continuation because of this logic, sort of logical argument, but more importantly, because of the argument of the primacy of the mind, that the mind comes first. So we look at the universe in the terms of, from the point of view of experience, here and now. And from the point of view of experience, we don't have any reason to believe that the death of the body ends this experience. I mean, if you've meditated enough, it just becomes absurd to think that this would just suddenly stop for no reason. Because we can see it continuing. You can see it not just continuing, but giving birth to new branches as you like something, as you want something, as you strive for something, or as you hate something, as you're averse to something. It's organic and it's mutating all the time. So to think that that should just stop is kind of a quaint sort of view from the point of view of an intensive meditator. I mean, it's easy for us to fall into that, because we've been brought up with the idea that death is it. Some of us, others of us who are, I don't know that I ever was, I don't know if I ever thought that death was it. Maybe I did, actually, and maybe it scared me. I remember when I was young, I was really scared of it. Some people don't. I mean, Christians are big on the one rebirth kind of thing, you know, being reborn in heaven or hell. And they're often excited to hear that there's more than one, there's a possibility for more than one rebirth. But, yeah, I mean, if you don't do a lot of meditation, it's really, and I think when you start meditating, it becomes a little confusing, because you don't see it, and because of your views. But I think that's all they are, is their views of death. Anyway. Buddhism is all about the present moment. The key is past lives, future lives don't really matter because they're past and future. It's an important part of the philosophy because it encourages us to strive, knowing that there are consequences to our actions. But really, that's all you need to get out of this, is that our actions have consequences. And if you act as though your actions have consequences, it doesn't matter whether you believe in rebirth or not, because there's an implicit belief there. Even if you say, well, I don't, but I'm still going to act as though there are consequences, rather than act like a jerk just because you can get away with it. When you die, well, that's it, you know. What's the worst? You're going to die. No, there's actually much worse than that. But if you act in terms of that's the worst that's going to happen, then it's problematic, because you can act in unwholesome ways. You're more likely to act in unwholesome ways. It's actually unpleasant for you. It creates problems for you when you act in unwholesome ways. So the most important thing is to act as though your actions have consequences. And learn to better yourself, to avoid unwholesome consequences.
Greetings, Bhante. My aunt told me she used to suffer from epilepsy when she was young, and as a result was put on medication for her seizures by her mid-20s. She was instructed to medicate every day for nearly 3 years, after which time her epilepsy was cured. She's now in her 60s and has not suffered from any seizures since. The doctor claimed through consistent dosing for periods of time, the medication would permanently change her brain chemistry. Would you please explain how the practices of formal insight meditation has similar effects, if any?
Yeah, I don't know. You mean like for epilepsy?
No, I think permanently changing brain chemistry would insight meditation.
My mother just sent me an article on it. I didn't read it. Yeah, the mind, everything changes your brain. If you do something enough, it changes your brain. As to what medication does, that's quite different. Medication changes it more, what's the word? More holistically, I guess. I don't know quite what the word is, but it's not pinpointing. You know, conscious activity like meditation will alter certain pathways in the brain. It's quite specific. But taking medication, you know, it pickles your brain. So it's a different kind of change. I don't really know how it does it. And it can target, I suppose it can target certain parts, but not really. The brain, you know, so these SSRIs, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, these are a lot of these psychoactive drugs that people take for anxiety and depression. They're not specific. They're not addressing the problem. Part of the problem is the pathways in the brain, the habits that have caused this, the pathways in the brain to change. But then you just soak that in this chemical that prevents the serotonin from leaving the bloodstream, I think, or something, so that you always have serotonin, which is a really nice feeling drug. But there's a word for this. It involves the entire brain. Global is, I think, the word I'm looking for. It's global. So it's a little bit different. Meditation and addiction also. Addiction is very much a specific pathway or a set of pathways that you're strengthening. So if you're mindful of your addiction, you slowly weaken and atrophy those connections. To simplify it, I'm not a neuroscientist, but
greetings all. I wanted to check if one can have tea, coffee, or avoid it completely, since it can also be in the category of chemicals and drugs leading to some addiction.
Yeah, it's not about leading to addiction. I mean, addiction is problematic, but the texts specifically mention alcohol. The Buddha specifically mentions alcohol because alcohol is something you can clearly, it's hard to deny that it changes the way you think. You know, it prevents you. It makes it very difficult for you to be mindful. So that's more of the question. Does this drug make it difficult or impossible for you to be mindful? Coffee doesn't really do that. And certain other drugs might not. Cigarettes probably doesn't make it difficult. So the difference, take the difference between cigarettes and alcohol. Alcohol intoxicates you. Really, you're drunk. Cigarettes don't do that. So they're addictive, they're bad, but they're probably not in the same, they're definitely not in the same category as alcohol, and so they're probably not to be considered under the fifth precept. Now, the thing you have to understand about precepts is they're vows you take. You can take a precept, I undertake not to take cigarettes, or I undertake not to drink coffee. That's your precept. It's a good one. There's reasons why. But generally, the five precepts that the Buddha recommended, I don't think include either caffeine or cigarettes. It's not to say that there's anything good about cigarettes, and coffee, I think, is 50-50, but there's nothing good about gambling either, and it's not in the five precepts, so they're just rules that you take. And they're not, just don't think these things are in the category of alcohol. So anyway, I have a couple more because it's 10 o'clock. I have Latin homework I still have to do.
There are a couple more. Did you want to put those off until tomorrow?
I go through them quickly. Let's not put. Oh, yeah. Okay, because tomorrow I don't have Dhammapada, so let's put them off.
Put them off until tomorrow? Okay.
You can bookmark that.
Sure.
Okay. Thanks, Robin. Thanks, everyone. Have a good night.
Thank you, Bhante. Good night.